In other news.
To determine why and how the towers collapsed.
Kind of scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to them and confront them. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. The banning of Alex Jones, who had millions of subscribers and billions of views on social media platforms, has been an eye-opening turning point in the selective censoring of free speech in the United States, but specifically about topics that are controversial, sensitive, and how a populist and libertarian movement may affect the outcome of another major election. The very people cheering about selective censoring of Alex Jones wouldn't be cheering if the same measures were brought down on them. The short-sightedness could partially stem from the hive minding and the actual social media entrainment. But now, as a handful of real voices lead discerning minds into investigating false flags, using weather as a weapon, and the epidemic of pedophile cults, that truth tsunami may simply be marginalized with algorithms. If that doesn't work, and your popularity still crashes through, the next step would be global capitalist control, pressured to silence your speech. The unclear and vague violations of terms of service, such as inciting hate speech, used for the mass banning, has been a backburner strategy to selectively censor any voice without a specific reason. YouTube in particular will state that it's due to multiple or severe violations of YouTube's policy against spam, deceptive practices, misleading content, or other terms of service violations. The problem is that there is impartial enforcement of the terms of service agreements executed with impunity. The safe spaces, coddling of younger generations, suggesting you're mentally incapable of making decisions about certain content is also a Trojan horse in continuity to justify this type of selected silencing. But it's not only the banning and censorship of voices and viewpoints on video sharing and social media platforms. MasterCard and Visa have also cut off services to conservative news organizations, ad revenue processing without explanation. And last week, 34-year-old chief executive of Automattic Inc. and creator of WordPress.com authorized a content-specific banning of WordPress hosted sites. Strangely, he's known to be a supporter of the Electronic Frontier Foundation and advocate of free speech and open source technology. According to the website thememoryhole.org, those sites include Chemtrails Planet and Cinderella's Broom that published important observations concerning the Newtown school shooting. Another issue buried here is that people are being trained that if you do produce investigative work on an issue beyond the mainstream media news sources on topics such as the Newtown, Connecticut school shooting or other potential false flag events, you're marked as a conspiracy theorist. There are now words you can't say on YouTube without getting a strike, such as crisis actor. But I would imagine those strikes are selective as well. Dr. Judy Wood had suggested that the 9/11 truth movement was created before the catastrophic events of September 11, 2001. Those involved in building the psychological operation knew there would be a percentage of people who wouldn't believe the 9/11 Commission report. So the large virtual arena is built to control the group who is searching for more information. Past guest Professor Eric Larson talked in depth about gatekeepers within the so-called progressive left. He called them infiltrating liars, acting as journalists. We hear an audio clip from past guest Matthew Deleuze, who calls this arena the second net.
Special people in the world today believe that they've woken up to the Matrix world, which I call the first net. The first net is the world that we lived in just a few years ago, where we thought everything were normal and we existed in a world that was true and honest, and we were trying to get through his lives the best way we can. These certain people, most of them just went through, were triggered emotionally to seek out the truth. Something was set off inside them to them in a way to seek out alternative information. Speaking of personal experience, I went through something in the mid-90s. I've been at this since then. In my case, I was emotionally triggered through many events in my life that made me question everything I was living and how I existed. Some people, a lot of people these days, are triggered by world events like 9/11. 9/11 was simply a big trigger to a lot of people, and it made them aware that the world wasn't right and they had to check into things. What I call the second net is where the people go when they've escaped from the first net. Obviously, I might be a bit crude calling it a second net off the top of my head, but I've been researching this for many, many years. I haven't just decided to start talking about a second net now. In fact, I first started writing about the second net in 2007, 2008.
Oh, really? What can you talk about that briefly so listeners have an idea of where you're coming from?
Well, for some reason, and you know, Jeff, I'm not a showbiz person. I'm not a media star. I'm grateful you have people like me on your show that's normal working people. But for some reason, be it a spiritual quest or whatever, I ended up behind the scenes in the truth movement and the New Age movement because I started writing about my experiences of waking up. And I automatically assumed when I went into the New Age and truth movement, everybody thought the same as me or had the same ideology as me and the same aim. And I came to an abrupt halt straight away as soon as I entered it because the people I was meeting in it didn't seem to have the same desires as me or the same hopes as me. I was seeing people that were only interested in what they could sell and how much money they could make. And it appeared to me when I went in trying to speak my part of the truth that these people were only interested in you if you were a showbiz personality that could attract the most amount of attention and therefore create webbits and sell things for them. In 2007, 2008, I were offered to do things. If I did things, I could become more popular. I'd be promoted and hyped. I'd call it hyped, not promoted, because that's what I see happen. But I'm not concerned about that side of things. I can only give my opinions on that because of personal experiences and the direction I was pushed in. What concerns me is that many, many people who think they're waking up to what's going on in the world are being pushed down a path to the same people at the same time. This is what concerns me at this present moment in time because it's not adding up to a truth movement that believes in free flow of information and supplying the truth. My own personal opinion is when these special people are triggered to seek the truth, it's caused from spiritual desires within them. Something has triggered the spiritual desires in these people to seek out the truth. Someone's pushed them, saying, come on, wake yourself up, something going on, start looking, start thinking for yourself. But apparently, when people do this, they look for comfort, they look for comradeship, they look for help, they look for people that are having similar experiences. And they basically, well, led into the truth movement. As soon as you're into the internet, onto the truth movement, or go to conferences, you're hit with all this information. And how it made me feel in the last few weeks, or months, is that the second net, the truth movement, the New Age movement, mostly attracts our emotions. That's what it does. It's taking your emotions that you once had for the first net, the world that we used to live in, the matrix, if you want to call it that, and then we end up directing our emotions into the truth movement and the second net, as I call it. The only thing that's happened is because we see the first net, the real world as we once lived in, we lose our emotions towards it. Once you see it's a fake, then you've no emotional connection to it. So I personally believe that the second net has now collected them emotions and put all our emotions into the second net. Now, that's fine if the truth movement and the New Age movement are honest and genuine and they're going to lead us to freedom and what have you. But if it's receiving that emotion. Emotions are used to create energy. And I personally believe, Jeff, that the second net is just doing the same thing as the first net.
That was past guest Matthew Deleuze. His essays can be found on oneballmedia.com. The issues with controversial events such as the Newtown School shooting in Connecticut or the Boston Marathon bombing come up as primary second net topics that are now being banned from public discussion. Let's hear from past guest Wolfgang Helbig, a former Florida State Trooper and National School Safety Consultant and researcher into the Newtown School shooting. This was an In Other News interview conducted in 2012 that aired on WBAI 99.5 FM. What other discrepancies did you also notice here that are glaring and a lot of people didn't notice?
Well, I think every parent today doesn't realize that 18 children, you said 20, I'm going to say this, 18 children and 6 staff members, teachers and assistants, were declared legally dead within the first 8 minutes from the time the first shot was fired. That is unbelievable in school shootings across the country. We've never heard of this before. When in Connecticut, only a doctor can declare somebody legally dead. So I want to know who declared all those children and teachers legally dead. Okay. Nobody will answer me. I've been doing this for 10 and a half months, politely. I've been courteous, sending in FOIA requests. I don't want to offend any parents. I don't want to offend the police departments, because I've been one of them. I know their job is tough. But why in the world would they not respond to me, and why will they not return any of my phone calls?
I wondered about that. So they're not responding. What do you think happened here? You have this individual, Adam Lanza, 20 years old, strapped down with ammunition and weaponry, and comes in there and shoots, you say, 18, kills 18 children. I don't know where the other two came in. I don't know.
We're going to talk about those other two.
Okay, so do you think this one person killed these 20 people?
Well, again, logically, I hope there are police officers who are listening today to the show. Parents, I want you to visualize this. You have a 20-year-old, they call him Adam Lanza. He is 6 feet tall during his autopsy. This is what they state. 6 feet tall. He only weighs 112 pounds. Now, he is supposedly carrying a rifle, a shotgun, 3 handguns, 7 magazines with 30 bullets each. He's got bullets in his pockets for the handguns. Now, he's going to go and shoot out the front window, go into the school, turn left, kill the principal, shoot the psychologist, kill both of them, go to room 8 and shoot 72 rounds, killing children there. Then he goes to room 10, shoots 83 shots, killing students and teachers there. Then he finally commits suicide in room 10. And he does all of that within 8 to 11 minutes. And he has a kill ratio, and a lot of people may not know what that means. He has a kill ratio of 99.9%. Jeff, there is not an FBI agent, Secret Service agent, or a Navy SEAL who is that proficient in weaponry.
Okay, that's a glaring anomaly in that somebody who may not have been professionally trained, an expert with munitions, can have a kill ratio at
99.9%.
That means that he every bullet he fired practically hit the target.
Absolutely. We teach our kids in high school, middle, and always ask questions. Don't be afraid to ask questions. And now, somehow, this country's changing. I mean, people, they're trampling on the Constitution. They're taking the guns away.
Wolfgang.
And it's all about Sandy Hook.
Right.
Well, what if Sandy Hook is not true?
Right.
What if it didn't happen?
You mean the official story isn't true?
Yeah. What if it's not true?
Okay. Law enforcement can be corrupt. You do know that government agencies and echelons of command can be corrupt. It's a reality. And
I saw that in Miami. Can I tell you about saw corruption in Miami.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that. A good example is the FBI using informants to entrap innocent people, and especially Muslims who they've targeted as being upset with the state of affairs in the United States, and they'll use an informant to coerce them into a particular crime. And I'm mentioning this because it's not uncommon for that type of behavior to occur within the FBI, where they use coercion, and they've been caught and sued and settled cases. So they've been caught red-handed doing similar things. With that lens, we can also examine some of these events as well, especially when there's a boatload of questions that come up within the official story. So as a state trooper in Miami, right?
Right. It was back in the 70s, and Jeff,
there wasn't visual evidence of 500 students evacuating the school.
Well, the police report, remember now, when I'm saying 500, the police report stated that that school on that day had 498 students that's supposed to have been in attendance, and they had 85 teachers on staff. So, you know, and they said, you know, a little quote, well, some might have been out sick, but again, it should have been 85 staff members. And the other one that's the big one is that I want to know, and every American ought to know, and they need to call their congressman today after this talk, after this show. They need to call their United States senator. Who directed the New Haven, Connecticut FBI field offices to classify the Sandy Hook School investigative report? That is unheard of.
It's unheard of for the FBI to classify investigations?
A school shooting, yes. Is Columbine classified? No. Virginia Tech? No. Jonesboro, Arkansas? No. Paducah? No. Bethel, Alaska? No. Red Lake? No.
If you don't think the individuals had died on that day that they say had died, that were killed, shot, the 20 children and the six adults, what do you think happened to them?
I think this is probably, Jeff, the best illusion that Homeland Security and FEMA has ever pulled off on the American people across all 50 states. I think it's been in planning for 2 to 3 years. I think it has specific objectives, is to create panic and fear across this country about guns and violence. And guess what? It played itself out in Connecticut. They're taking guns away from law-abiding citizens.
I understand we're not allowed to see their children in the morgue?
Listen to Dr. Carver, who is the chief of medical examiner for the state of Connecticut. He told each of those parents, okay, that they need to look at a picture of their child, that they did not make contact with them at any time. What that means is they never got to see their child in the morgue. Can you imagine any parent? Somebody's going to stick a picture in your face? That's not going to suffice for me. This is not within our human nature. Human nature tells us, I'm going to run over you. I'm going to kick that door down because I'm going to hug my baby. I'm going to hug my child. I'm going to kiss it. I'm going to grab it. I'm not going to let my baby leave this world all by herself or himself.
Right, as
it's
a parent.
Not within our human nature, Jeff.
Okay, so you're telling me that the parents never got to see the ones that were killed from the day that they left to go to school to the casket?
Based on Dr. Carver's testimony, yes. When a parent doesn't file a lawsuit, especially, can you imagine, you just lost a child in a public school system, and you expect that public school system to be just like another parent in loco parentis. We're supposed to love and protect them when they're in our custody. And guess what? The child dies, and nobody files a lawsuit. Remember, Columbine, 14 students die. Guess what? 14 parents filed a lawsuit. 23 students at Columbine were severely, severely shot and injured. Every one of those parents filed a lawsuit. 20 children dead, 6 adults, not one lawsuit filed. See, I know why they didn't file a lawsuit. See, people don't understand. Why is it people don't file a lawsuit? It's because of exposure.
There's another aspect here, that is the fundraisers that occurred after this event to compensate the victims. Tell us about that.
Well, one that's really glaring is, why would General Motors, now think about General Motors.
Well, you said General Electric. You said General Electric.
General Electric.
Is it General? Sorry. Who is it?
I'm sorry. I apologize. General Motors, forgive me.
Okay.
General Electric, GE, donated $15 million to the Sandy Hook Foundation. Why? Because Adam Lanza's dad has a connection with GE. And it's just, these things are just, the money that was taken in, over $29 million was donated, and nobody knows where the money went. There's no accounting for it. I mean, who got the money? And when we go up to Sandy Hook in May, we're going to go check out each of those nonprofit organizations, and we're going to inspect each of those financial records as to who contributed and who got the money. And remember, when you pass out money, you have to justify the expenditures. So we're taking attorneys with us. We're taking an accountant with us. So we're allowed to inspect those records by the IRS rules. I think at the end of the day, you're going to find out that Homeland and FEMA try to pull off a trick. I think they try to really make America believe that children died on that day. And, you know, I told you, I pray to God I'm wrong. But the information, the puzzles doesn't fit. You can't have that many mistakes. You can't have, I mean, think about Columbine, Sandy Hook. Columbine, Sandy Hook. We should have learned from Columbine. Sandy Hook is worse than Columbine. And how is that even possible? And I'll give you an example. Oxford, Connecticut is right next to Sandy Hook in Newtown. They just had a drill, you know, one of those active shooter drills, just about 6 months earlier, and they even had the Lieutenant Vance participating in it. And guess what's landing during the drill with the media, with their TV cameras out there filming it? What's landing during a drill? Helicopter, trauma helicopter. Every time they do a drill, trauma helicopters. Now we have a mass shooting, 20 children, 6 teachers, and we don't even order the trauma helicopters. See, that just doesn't even make sense.
Somebody posted online a short video showing that a number of homes right around that area in Sandy Hook were purchased on Christmas of 2009. A lot of those homes were purchased on 2009 around Sandy Hook.
Well, think about the odds. Remember, first of all, you got to think about Sandy Hook. It's supposed to have almost, it's got 500 students, okay? What are the odds that 18 out of the 20 children who died that day, those parents all moved in the year of 2009? 18 out of the 20. Unbelievable. And they hardly, I don't think they paid anything for their houses. And if you go up to Sandy Hook today, they don't live in Sandy Hook anymore. They're all disappeared. Where do they go? I've seen parents who've lost children. I mean, as a school administrator, I've had school shootings. I've had children die in our schools. Guess what? They didn't move. They didn't leave town. These people all disappeared.
Wolfgang mentions, now this was nearly 6 years ago, that we teach our kids to always, always ask questions. Don't be afraid to ask questions, meaning don't shut down dialogue, because by hearing from a variety of sources, a broader perspective on an issue is obtained. Let's hear some of a past show airing clips from the 3-hour documentary, The Boston Unbombing. The producer of this documentary presents forensic analysis of photographic evidence revealing silicone tubes carrying fake blood used in emergency drills in the film industry worn by the victims in the Boston Marathon bombing.
This is an article from Fox News about the benefits of hyper-realistic medical emergency training. The article reads, quote, "Makeup artists create combat wounds that bleed actively from hidden tubes," unquote. At the right is a still frame from the video accompanying this article, and it shows a crisis actor using the fake blood delivery system. I'm sure you get the point by now, but here's another product that includes a tube that sends fake blood squirting out of a gruesome moulage wound. Of course, you'd probably want to hide the tube a bit better than that in a disaster drill or a trauma simulation drill. Now, if you're doing an emergency drill, you don't really need a super-duper realistic silicone moulage sleeve, nor would you need a particularly deceptively hidden fake blood tube delivery system. The photo at the top is a demo of a fake blood tube simply tucked under a flesh-colored sleeve and simulating bleeding through some holes in the sleeve. That wouldn't pass in a Hollywood movie. The silicone sleeve on the bottom, on the other hand, is quite convincing. You can hardly see the edges. Sneak a fake blood tube under there, and you're ready for the big screen. As for the Boston unbombing, the Boston unbombing was not quite ready for the big screen. Remember I told you about the Thorndike set of photos? This is Thorndike 7, capturing 5 seconds after the pyrotechnic display. Now we'll magnify the area of the picture where the blue arrow is pointing. This fellow was a crisis actor named Eric Whaley, who, according to the official story, had his pants blown off by a shrapnel-filled bomb. We see no evidence from this angle that his legs are bleeding. We do, however, see an anomalous line all the way across the top of his left thigh, which is direct evidence, as several more photographs over the next several slides will prove, that he is wearing a thin silicone sleeve over his upper left thigh. The photo on the right has the contrast enhanced in order to see the line on his thigh more clearly. Just to help you out, on the photo on the left, I drew a blue line over the line across his thigh. Just to be extra clear, the area now colored green is where the silicone sleeve is pulled up over his upper thigh. Okay, please understand that I'm not asking you to come to a conclusion from this photo alone. I will soon be showing you other photos, including a very clear high-resolution close-up of this silicone sleeve over his upper thigh, with a fake blood tube under it. But our purposes for now are just to establish that this line around his leg was there immediately after the pyrotechnic display.
That was audio from a past show discussing the documentary The Boston Unbombing. YouTube had removed the originally uploaded video, but luckily it was re-uploaded on another platform. Remember, when people criticize honest questioning of an official narrative, make sure they're using facts and evidence. If instead you're hearing name-calling and adjectives describing an emotional response without addressing anything specific, that's usually an indicator of a prejudice. The narrator in the Boston Unbombing closes the documentary discussing how it's possible the crisis actors were coerced into participating. He says, quote, "There are some serious psychopaths and sociopaths down in the U.S. deep state crawling along a criminal web extending through various governmental agencies and military channels and headquarters of financial cartels and corporate conglomerates, making use of patsies. A controlled second net can only last so long, especially if it stops working as intended. Yet many examples have shown the hypocrisy of the selective shutting down of so-called hate speech. The New York Times hired the, and I know this is old news, but they hired a woman to their editorial board that sent out some of the most racist, hateful tweets in the past against white men. I understand the greater divide and conquer agenda to get racists fighting each other. It's an especially profound thing to watch after reading the book They Were Slaves and They Were White by Michael Hoffman and realizing that this important piece of redacted history, where from the mid-1600s to the early 1800s, more than 250,000 white people were enslaved, beaten, and killed. To have this information competently understood amid our society would quickly put an end to not only the divisive, vitriolic, racist hatred cast against white people in the United States in 2018, but also the white guilt. When we learn about any type of slavery, we also learn that racism is an engineered construct weakening the fabric of society. Mark Passio, a past guest, stated, as a former high priest in the Church of Satan, he said the church's goal is to enslave mankind. Mark is no longer involved and is producing fantastic presentations exposing the occult agenda, but let's hear him talk about those who attended the ritual gatherings. I saw that you mentioned your position as a priest in the Satanic Church at one time. Can you talk about that, why you left, and what you gained from that in terms of understanding those who are within that religion, the Satanic Church, what they're doing, and how they're manipulating various aspects of humanity.
Sure. In my youth, I was born into a standard traditional Roman Catholic family in South Philadelphia, and my family was the type of people who just accepted the status quo at face value and never really asked any deep questions. You know, the question why was unheard of in generally in my family. You know, not that they were bad and moral people, but they were just not really deep thinkers. They're just go along to get along types, generalizing. I was born into that indoctrination and programming, as are most people, let's face it. I mean, you know, it's a rare thing when somebody is not born into something like that, that has conscious parents, and they are very, very gifted to be born to conscious parents and a conscious family. But it's a very few and far between scenario. So, of course, being born into this religious indoctrination, I accepted without a lot of questioning what I was being taught by my parents, my teachers, et cetera, sent to, you know, Catholic school. And my late grade school years, maybe even into very early high school years, like freshman year. And then I started questioning that belief, but all that questioning wasn't channeled in any kind of a healthy way. It was all just turned to anger and hatred about what I simply perceived as being lied to at that point. Not consciously, I knew these people didn't understand what it really was about either, but I still lacked an important framework. That framework, by the way, was astrotheology. Because once you understand astrotheology and you understand the origins of religion, and then you understand what religion is being used to do in society, that knowledge is empowering, and it helps you to break that paradigm. And you could do it in a productive and channeled way instead of in a scattered and completely imbalanced way like I broke the indoctrination, but I went from one form of indoctrination to another form of deception. Mm-hmm. As a result of how I broke it without knowledge, you know. I started gravitating to the exact antithesis of this belief system. I wanted to go into the occult. And I mean, not just hidden knowledge, I wanted to go into the dark occult, hidden knowledge that's wielded to control others, you know, and it's, you know, Satanism and, you know, darkness and the exact opposite of God. You know, I was looking for that. And I found it in a big way. It wasn't difficult to find. Mm-hmm. You know, they're out there. So I became involved with dark occultism, with Satanism in particular, was the they call it the left-hand path. That was the path that I got involved in. I started espousing satanic ideology through writing and music in the vein of that type of ideology, which was being put out there by the Church of Satan. Which was then run by Anton LaVey. Mm-hmm. He's since died, and they have new leadership. But LaVey himself appointed me a priest in his organization because, again, not because I went into the organization and was trying to move up in the ranks. He contacted me and said, I like the work that you've been doing about communicating the satanic ideology and worldview to other people through your writing and music. He actually noticed what I was doing. And said, I want you to be a spokesperson and a priest in my organization. So I accepted. Mm-hmm. I said, yes, I want to become further involved. And he wanted me to start what's called a grotto. It's the equivalent in Satanism of a coven, mm-hmm. where you are, you know, beginning a organization in your area that espouses this system and pulls other people into the fold. And I didn't accept that. I said, no, I consider Satanism a pretty individual thing. And I don't want to begin a grotto and take on that work and responsibility. I'd rather just practice it in my own life. I said, what I will do is I'll attend some in this area if you have any contacts. And some other people put me in contact with other individuals in this area, not LaVey himself, but people who were involved in the Church of Satan. Satanism to me was a personal thing when I started getting involved in it. And it was just like, you know, you went and studied this knowledge about how to manipulate people because you know more about how the psyche works than they do to get what you want, to gain a tactical advantage over other people or to get them to grant you favors or give you positions of influence that you may want, okay? Mm-hmm. That's what it was to me. Is that what it is? Yes, that's partially what it is, but it's so much more than that once you get to a certain level of understanding, once you get to see what this interconnected network of people really is doing. And when I started attending these grottos and seeing who was involved in these organizations, I became aware that I had become involved at a low level with a very organized syndicate that wasn't working, you know, just to work with hidden knowledge about the psyche to just increase their own individual members' power. They were working together. They were working as a tight-knit unit, actually, that was trying to advance the entire group, the entire network or hierarchy's power at the expense of everybody else's rights and freedoms. You know, it was essentially they were claiming to be masters of the world because of the knowledge that they held, and everybody else was essentially going to become their slaves, you know, in so many words. You know, I didn't understand that for many years, but that's how that they were working. I didn't understand some of their terminology, their esoteric terminology. Like, they call the average person the dead. The dead. What started leading me to believe I was involved in something that was way over my head and that I should probably not be involved with was the who populated these groups. Who populated these groups were people of power and influence in every single social institution on the face of the earth. You name the institution, okay? Banking, politics, media, law, law enforcement, entertainment, technology, education, military, medicine, you name the institution. There were people at the highest levels of these institutions that were Satanists and were attending satanic rituals at satanic grotto meetings.
Mark's work can be found at whatonearthishappening.com. Meanwhile, Google, Facebook, phone companies constantly breach your trust, handing over your personal correspondence to the NSA, selling your data, tracking your every move, and plans have been drafted to monitor every facet of future generation humans in stack and pack buildings. Total enslavement is on the agenda 2030. In order for that to happen, you set up a surveillance system stalking humans 24/7. Remember when Florida Senator Kathy Castor asked Mark Zuckerberg about Facebook tracking and collecting data on its users? Let's have a listen.
For all of the benefits that Facebook has provided in building communities and connecting families, I think a devil's bargain has been struck. And in the end, Americans do not like to be manipulated. They do not like to be spied on. We don't like it when someone is outside of our home watching. We don't like it when someone is following us around the neighborhood, or even worse, following our kids or stalking our children. Facebook now has evolved to a place where you are tracking everyone. You are collecting data on just about everybody. Yes, we understand the Facebook users that proactively sign in are in part of that platform, but you're following Facebook users even after they log off of that platform and application, and you are collecting personal information on people who do not even have Facebook accounts. Isn't that right?
Congresswoman, I believe that
yes
we...
Yes or no?
Congresswoman, I'm not sure. I don't think that that's what we're tracking.
No, you're collecting, you have already acknowledged that you are doing that for security purposes and commercial purposes. So you're collecting data outside of Facebook. When someone goes to a website and it has the Facebook like or share, that data is being collected by Facebook, correct?
Congresswoman,
yes or no?
That's right, that we understand in order to show which of your friends.
Yeah, so for people that like don't even have Facebook, I don't think that the average American really understands that today, something that fundamental. And that you're tracking everyone's online activities, their searches. You can track what people buy, correct?
Congresswoman.
You're collecting that data, what people purchase online.
Actually, if they share it with us, but Congresswoman,
because it has
overall,
a share button, so it's gathering. Facebook has the application. In fact, you've patented applications to do just that. Isn't that correct? To collect that data.
Congresswoman, I don't think any of those buttons share transaction data. But broadly,
they track you. You're collecting medical data, correct, on people that that are on the internet, whether they're Facebook users or not, right?
Congresswoman, yes, we collect some data for
security. And you're collecting, you watch where we go. Senator Durbin had a funny question yesterday about where you're staying, and you didn't want to share that, but Facebook also gathers that data about where we travel, isn't that correct?
Congresswoman, everyone has control over how that works.
I'm going to get to that, but yes, you are. Would you just acknowledge it? Yes, Facebook is, that's the business you're in, gathering data and aggregating that data.
Congresswoman, right? I disagree with that characterization.
You're not, are you saying you do not gather data on where people travel based upon their internet and the ways they sign in and things like that?
Congresswoman, the primary way that Facebook works is that people choose to share data, and they share
primary way, but the other way that Facebook gathers data is you buy data from data brokers outside of the platform, correct?
Congresswoman, we just announced 2 weeks ago that we were going to stop interacting with data brokers, and even though that's an industry norm, to make it so that the advertising can be more relevant.
But I think in the end, it's practically impossible these days to remain untracked in America for all the benefits Facebook has brought and the internet. And that's not part of the bargain. And current laws have not evolved, and the Congress has not adopted laws to address digital surveillance. And Congress should act. And I do not believe that the controls, the opaque agreement, consent agreements, the settings are an adequate substitute for fundamental privacy protections for consumers. Now,
Gentle East time.
The New York Times reported on how Google and other tech corporations have conspired to work together at the Bilderberg meetings in 2013. What is the Bilderberg Group, you ask? Past guest Daniel Estulin, author of the true story of the Bilderberg Group, says imagine a private club where presidents, prime ministers, international bankers, and generals meet, where gracious, royal chaperones ensure everyone gets along, and where the people running the wars, markets, and Europe and America say what they never dare say in public. I heard Professor Jordan Peterson in one interview say that now Alex Jones' followers will now have more reason to believe in his conspiracies. Well, listeners, he might be controlled opposition. The material he's putting out there is divisive at times, especially characterizing all people on the left as pink-haired, overweight, wild-eyed social justice warriors or black scarf club-wielding Antifa. It's a caricature by default that makes InfoWars reporters appear calm, logical, and normal, which isn't hard to do because the left has been hijacked for years with the spread of identity politics. When given a chance to speak their minds at rallies, anti-Trump protesters often appear inarticulate, the core of their political position is emotionally driven, accompanied by personal attacks. But it doesn't stop there. This has been a full-scale attack against rational, fact-based discussion. This isn't the left. Many are paid actors, imposters, out on the streets to further an agenda masked as the left wing. Professor Jordan Peterson calls them postmodern Marxist communists. He says essentially they bristle at you expressing your hard-won freedoms of press, speech, and right to bear arms. The reason this is important is because CNN, the cable news network, broadcast opinion-led anti-Trump rhetoric that could incite hate and violence at the cost of losing viewers and revenue. It doesn't matter to them. MSNBC, CNNBC, late-night talk shows, Hollyweird actors, and many other outlets have circled the wagons, becoming an anti-Trump chorus line. This is a dangerous game that fosters division within the public consciousness. Remember that clip of the CNN reporter Jim Acosta and White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders responding to Acosta's comment that media is not the enemy of the people.
I just wanted to follow up on Sarah's question from NPR. She asked you about Ivanka Trump's statement that the press is not the enemy of the people. And she asked you whether or not the press is the enemy of the people. You read off a laundry list of your concerns about the press and things that you feel like are misreported, but you did not say that the press is not the enemy of the people. And I think it would be a good thing if you were to say right here at this briefing that the press, the people who are gathered in this room right now, doing their jobs every day, asking questions of officials like the ones you brought forward earlier, are not the enemy of the people. I think we we deserve that.
I think the president has made his position known. I also think it's ironic.
Would you mind telling us,
I'm trying to answer your question.
Okay, well,
I politely waited, and I even called on you despite the fact that you interrupted me while calling on your colleague.
Well,
I said it's ironic.
Which is why I interrupted.
I'm trying.
But if you finish, if you would not mind letting me have a follow-up, that would be fine. But
it's ironic, Jim, that not only you and the media attack the president for his rhetoric when they frequently lower the level of conversation in this country. Repeatedly, the media resorts to personal attacks without any content other than to incite anger. The media has attacked me personally on a number of occasions, including your own network, said I should be harassed as a life sentence, that I should be choked. ICE officials are not welcomed in their place of worship, and personal information is shared on the internet. When I was hosted by the Correspondents Association, of which almost all of you are members of, you brought a comedian up to attack my appearance and call me a traitor to my own gender. In fact, as I know, I'm the first press secretary in the history of the United States that's required Secret Service protection. The media continues to ratchet up the verbal assault against the president and everyone in this administration, and certainly we have a role to play, but the media has a role to play for the discourse in this country as well.
If I may follow up,
why is CNN reporter Jim Acosta saying, because he's there every day doing his job, therefore CNN must not be the enemy of the people? It's that type of bullying logic that prompted the fake news label initially. It doesn't matter who is president, you're likely not going to receive an accurate, wide range of fair and balanced news coverage from these outlets. It's been proven time and again, but it doesn't matter. CNN, which is now called the fake news network by many people, is piped into most airports, commercial gyms, and hotel bars. It's hard to escape if you don't know who the enemy is. But also, people in this country are lied to every time the country is being led into another war. Bubbling under the surface, however, and I think this is part of why the censorship hammer was dropped, is the wide exposure of the pedophile epidemic within the communities across the country. This epidemic has been allowed to fester in the shadows for a long time, but what's also important to connect here is the occult demon-worshipping element. It's no accident that as the pedophile epidemic is being exposed, a wall of censorship is rising. Remember what Mark Passio said about the bankers, law enforcement, teachers, basically those at the top of every facet of industry being involved in the satanic grottos. Pay attention to what past guest Lori Handrahan says about those involved in child rape. She's the author of Epidemic, America's Trade in Child Rape, published by Trinday. Let's have a listen.
Think about this clinically, which I try to do, and analytically. It's really easy to understand pedophiles' behavior, and it's this. Wherever there are children, whether they're at camp, a sleepaway camp in Maine or upstate New York, whether they're at choir practice or piano lessons or swim camp, whether they're in daycare or primary or secondary school or special needs children in a classroom or terminally ill children at a children's hospital, pedophiles have set up a secure supply line. That's what they do. That's how they commit their crime. So if you just think about what are all the ways that you could access children, and then you think about what is a career that I could craft for myself that would allow me daily access to vulnerable children to rape, those are the careers that pedophiles populate. So daycares is very popular, pediatricians, pediatric oncologists, child psychologists, child protective services, humanitarians who work with child refugees or children who have suffered already rape in war zones, like Joel Davis was doing, primary school, secondary school teachers, huge. It's huge within our education system. USA Today did an outstanding investigation, and I reference this in my book. It's one of the only large-scale investigations of child sex abuse among primary and secondary school teachers that I've seen in this country. They were well-funded and well-supported internally, and I think they looked at over a million documents. And what they did was, within USA Today's network around the country, you know, there's local reporters who work for a local newspaper and it's part of this USA Today network, went down to the courthouse and got the criminal complaints and got the documents and started to detail how many teachers have been arrested for child sex crimes, including child pornography and hands-on abuse. And it's staggering. And how many of them are rehired, even though they're registered sex offenders. So they'll be a registered sex offender. They will have served time in Alaska. And then when they get out of jail, they'll move to Maine and they'll be hired again as a primary school teacher with nobody checking the records and no central database where anybody can check the records.
That seems like they're protecting the abusers here.
Well, yes. Yeah. So if you look at one population, I have this also online. If you look at the arrest of primary and secondary school teachers, what you'll see, again, it's the men in leadership positions. So most primary and secondary school teachers, it's a profession dominated largely by women. And although more women are engaged in this crime, it's 80 to 90% men, and it's 80 to 90% white men, according to the U.S. Sentencing Commission. So when you look at primary and secondary schools, where do you see, I don't know if it's the most arrests, because we don't have any reliable large-scale data yet, but most of the arrests that I see when I do my searches are of the principals and the school board members. So you will see many white male principals and many school board directors and school board members who are white men being arrested for child pornography. So you're right. They are protecting each other, which is a key element of the crime. That's not a conspiracy. That's part of the criminal activity.
Dr. Hanrahan, can you tell listeners about your research into how many local and state police officers have been arrested for child pornography-related charges?
That just really, the police makes me, I don't know, it's hard to say which profession makes me more upset because they're all so horrifying. But I started to look at how many police were being arrested. And on the positive side, there's a lot of amazing, dedicated, honest law enforcement in our country who are actually arresting their own colleagues. And so we have to remember that. If you see the arrest of 100 police officers, which I've profiled under one of my Medium posts, that means that correspondingly there were more than 100 good cops who arrested the bad cops and prosecuted them. And what I've come to understand in extensive conversations with many law enforcement that I have as I've investigated these arrests around the country, is that nobody hates a bad cop more than a good cop. I mean, these good cops that I talk to are so horrified that their own colleagues are doing this, that they will take these cases very seriously and investigate and prosecute. I guess it's a little bit like how I feel about Joel Davis being arrested. It's one of my own community members, and it horrifies me, and I'm furious about it. And that's what police will express to me when I've called them and said, hey, you investigated the police chief who was arrested in your district. Can you tell me a little bit about what happened? So I stopped counting because this research, I've been doing it unpaid and by myself. So at a certain point, I just can't do it anymore because it's incredibly painful and very depressing. So I have, a little bit over 100 examples of police officers. And again, when you start to look at any cohort, what you immediately start to see is that typically it's not the low-level guy who's doing it. It's the top guy. It's the police chief. So I had to make a separate section for police chiefs and sergeants and lieutenants and deputy police chiefs because those were the guys who were being arrested overwhelmingly, not the uniform officer on the street. Right? The military, too. If you look at the military arrests, which I have up, you're seeing it's the top military guys being arrested over and over. Another mainstream media investigation that was outstanding was AP, Associated Press, and I referenced this in the book, did an amazing year-long investigation into child sex abuse, including child pornography, in the military. And they came up with the same results that I did, that it was the leadership, that it was white men in positions of power in the military, overwhelmingly, who were being caught. And we only know about the guys who get caught, of course, and that's only a very small indication about the amount of people who are doing this who have not yet been caught.
Lori Hanrahan, author of Epidemic, America's Trade in Child Rape. Another sensitive area of research intrinsically linked with the child abuse networks is the ancient practice of adrenochrome harvesting. Adrenochrome is a chemical compound produced by the oxidation of adrenaline. It's generated by creating intense fear affecting the child's endocrine system, forcing it to release adrenaline in the blood. That blood is consumed and is known to be a revitalizing elixir that's very addictive. The ritual dates back to ancient cultures such as the Aztecs, early Egyptian dynasties, and Vlad the Impaler. In another cauldron bubbling away online is the Pizzagate controversy, where thousands of hacked emails from Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign chairman, John Podesta, were released in monthly bursts in 2016 by WikiLeaks. Julian Assange's mother hinted at Seth Rich's death recently. Christine Assange wrote in a tweet, "It is the duty of the media to inform citizens about corruption. A hashtag DNC, hashtag Bernie supporter, disgruntled with rigging, leaked documents proving corruption. What should WikiLeaks have done? Hold on to them until after the election to advantage hashtag Hillary? You are shooting the messenger." Well, interesting, Seth Rich did get shot and killed. That data dump included a lot of emails from John Podesta, which led into the Pizzagate scandal. I suspect no amount of censorship is going to erase the damage from that data dump. Some say Seth Rich paid with his life. Julian Assange is being tortured and his life is at risk. Many refuse to investigate Pizzagate because once again the chorus line of CNN late-night talk show hosts MSNBC told them not to. Despite the frantic backpedaling and implementation of filtering so-called fake news by the power structure, citizen journalists and armchair warriors on many levels and unearthed disturbing images, artwork, and powerful associations within a pizza restaurant owner's Instagram account and archived it before it was switched to private. There are very few moments in television history when a coordinated effort by networks, celebrities, politicians, and talk show hosts would shamelessly admonish viewers to stop asking questions about Comet Ping Pong and related controversy. The opposite usually occurs, and it did. Because of the recent deplatforming of Alex Jones, he's more popular than ever. Was he a controlled opposition patsy set up to nosedive the second net plane and create that justification to selectively censor content? Will regulations be enforced to break up big tech companies, creating honest systems based on the decisions of real people, allowing the free market of ideas to flourish? Or is this phase one of a deeper dismantling of communication, executed in preparation for a more sinister future scenario? That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Join me again Monday, 11 p.m. Visit inothernewsradio.com for past shows and more information about the guests.